maybe you can just give us a little insight about how you've known Mr. Nichols, Mike, over the years, before leading up to around the graduate.
It's a sordid and uninteresting tale, but I'll try and make it short. We've known each other since childhood, but weren't really aware of that fact. And then I was hanging around the set of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf because George Segal was a very old friend of mine. We'd been worked in a theater together, and we were palling around in Los Angeles. And one day, Mike said to me, would you read this book? I have no idea why he said that. What was I doing? I was working on Get Smart at the time, which was not the most obvious stepping stone to the graduate, but that's where it started.
Do you remember where we met? It was based on where we met that I thought. We met at Jane Fonda's gigantic party.
Oh, that's true.
With a tree growing up.
You had been invited.
I remember the first thing we said to each other.
Uh-oh.
Because the birds were about to sing or play or whatever they did. And you said, are you happy? Do you like it here? And I said, yes, here under the shadow of this great tree, I have found peace. And we started a conversation pretty much in that vein. And then, because I had not a good script that somebody had, my producers had written while I was doing the other movie, I thought, here's the guy. And look what happened.
Look, and there were, it all ends up here tonight.
Well, it's all certainly ongoing. I mean, as we've seen already in the retrospective, the screenings of The Graduate have been jam-packed, and there are new.
And it's on Turner tonight.
As opposed to last night. But something must have clicked for both of you after that film. Clearly you knew each other before, but I guess maybe just to share with us what that moment was like, or the moments in 1967 when the film hit and the audiences reacted the way that they did.
I remember not that so much as our New York preview, which was at the RKO 86 week, which was like 2,000 people something before they cut it up into different movies. And we hadn't mixed it yet. I was running on this black box. Were you there?
No.
And it was terrifying because the audience for the last 7 minutes or so stood up and screamed like at a prize fight. And we're all scared. We think something bad has happened because it seemed insane. And poor Dustin was seeing it for the first time upstairs in the balcony. And he came out afterwards, he was white as a sheet. It was this startling thing that happened. Because, you know, we just thought it was the movie we made. This is what I thought the other night when we were looking at Carnal Knowledge, that what we forget with all our DVDs and our watching movies on TV and everything, we forget the essential experience, which is, of course, on a big screen, and with an audience. That some of the events can't take place while you're lying on your bed eating pizza, busy checking the BlackBerry. It's a completely, totally different experience because all of you in the dark are silently having a similar experience to the things that aren't spoken. The laughs are the laughs and all that thing, but the thing that underneath that makes it a movie is entirely different in front of an audience.
Yeah.
And I actually forgot until Carnal Knowledge. I thought, look, there's a shot of Aunt Margaret, and nothing's going to happen for a minute and a half. She's not going to make another face, and she's not going to say anything. But with an audience, it becomes something happening. And we get out of... And that was our shock with The Graduate.
I was not in this country, so I came back after it had been playing at that theater on 57th Street for about 2 months. And I went to it, and the theater was still full. And to my horror, the kids who had seen it already, who were there, were reciting the lines a few seconds before the actors did. It was very spooky.
One other thing you might find interesting is Joseph E. Levine, before the picture opened or had a preview, decided the thing was for me to... Excuse me. tour the colleges with the movie. So I toured the colleges with the movie. And I don't know what's happening. It was maybe four or five colleges. And I don't think anybody in this theater can possibly guess what the question was, what the topic was that they brought up, maybe 80% of the time. What about Vietnam? Because there was no way to be current. There was no way to be a student if you didn't feel very deeply about Vietnam. And the fact that the movie wasn't about Vietnam seemed to them sort of vulgar and self-concerned and not what they wanted. Until it opened. And then they totally turned around, and that, because it was an experience of theirs, but that correctness that had started on the campuses already caused the questions to be about what you were supposed to do, how correct you were supposed to be. And then when it became a thing to them that they thought was about them, that was cool. But then they learned the lines.
Much has been made recently about that year, 67, and specifically the films that were up for awards that year. And none of them had addressed Vietnam, but there was race, and then your film, which was Youth, and Dr. Doolittle. Right, exactly. But there was certainly a political moment that you were entering into, and your films have continued to kind of have a dialogue in and around politics. Ms. Efron and Ms. May, you both worked on films with Mike that have had political resonance, even if it's with Silkwood specifically about potentially policy on a more intimate level, on how regulation can affect individual
life.
I'm
very anxious to hear the end of this sentence. It's always good to know your movies together.
When I saw Silkwood, I was being educated in the end, thank you. Slightly older, but it was definitely in "This is a film you should see because it's a cause. It's about a cause." And when I look at it now, it's about people for me. And I think, in a way, that's where politics has come back to, we hope, to being about people. And with Primary Colors, you definitely get that glimpse of the inside, the kind of the icky inside of politics. But I'm just wondering, to have The Graduate, and let's segue then onto the other films as well, enter into this very political moment, was that something that, it didn't obviously leave a bad taste in your mouth about dealing with taking politics on in your films?
I never thought of it as politics. I thought of it as, for want of a better word, society. I like and I have fun with mores, not the eels. Because it gives you one more thing to have a good time with. You and the cast and the DP and everybody. You got your plot, you got your surprises, you got your scenes. But if you have something to deal with the designers about, the costumes about it, it's just like when we, and it always has to do with something social and or political. I like that because it's the last thing remaining from when we did nothing but make fun of that. And whenever we come together, which is on numerous movies, Birdcage most openly, Elaine used to come in and save me on other movies, but would we take credit, which is a trick she has. but that fun that we have making fun of the ways people do things, I like to get back in movies. I think it gives it a nice extra something.
Well, let's run with that, because you've talked to me about the best actors, and I'm assuming this applies to writers as well, understand comedy. You want to bring that up, because you've all been involved, or many of you have been involved with sketch comedy as well, on the stage, and that interaction with the audience.
I do think that. I think that all the actors that I love are in some way coming out of comedy. either openly or the way you were funny at Yale or whatever. There was comedy was always part of it. And the material of the comedy I liked very much and loved it. I don't know who was around when Strangelove was on just a few months ago. And man, it just took you back and back to who Kubrick was when he made it. And the improv, oh my God, the improvisation in it. When Peter Bull breaks up with Peter Sellers and Scott is improvising. They're all improvising. He went with what the actors did and then, for his own reasons, became more and more, they'll do it again, and they control it more and more. I revere that impulse to wing it whenever you can afford it, when you've got some structure, some bones, and a purpose, a reason to be telling the story. You can then, it's possible to fool around a little bit and get some of it. What was your question?
No, I mean, it's also, I've discovered a way that you can not let people off the hook, especially with Ms. May. You don't suffer fools. So it's, and I know that you can use kind of the wit in your films and in your sketch comedy to enlighten people about how silly they can be sometimes.
Well, we always, when it was always we who were silly. They never knew that we were making fun of us. That was our secret. They all said it was scathing sociological comments. It was just us.
Do you agree?
I'm sorry.
Given to calling these five the smartest people in the universe, so you can imagine, give all of your nervousness to me, because I've got plenty, and talk to us about doing comedy with Mike or anybody.
Well,
be just the teeniest bit more specific.
You just began in that
that. There's nothing around you.
Well, when you begin, you really don't know that anyone else will find you funny. Mm-hmm. You just know that, it's what Mike said, we were very snotty. But, so when we made fun of ourselves, it was something that nobody but us, we were the ones who saw it and nobody else. And it was a surprise to see that everyone was like that. That everyone had that number. And that everyone who's that nervous on that day, man or woman or possibly creature. So, and it was, as you learn it, that gives you a certain confidence. Just that you think, oh, look how alike everybody
we are.
Yes.
Another thing, in addition to that, that somebody said, I think today in the paper, that our job, certainly, actor's job, my job, and in some cases the writer's job, is to make a case for the character. It never works if you condemn a character. You know, it's two-dimensional and not interesting. You don't have a plot, you don't have a story, you don't have life. And in making the case for the character, funny is incredibly useful. Because even if you're looking at somebody, a villain, when they're funny, you somehow forgive, you somehow connect, you somehow put them in with the people in your life. And I think that's the main job, you know, to make that connection for us and then for everybody else. And I can't bear doing it without that. I just don't know how you do it.
But I think also that to be funny, if you're just not romantic, if you just do the details, if you just don't tear the bra off, if you understand it at a moment, you're going to say, how does this thing open? And if you
how to get the nightgown off.
If you realize that you're going to have sex, but it's not the best underwear you have. If you just do what really happens, what really, really happens, I think that's the closest, the detail of it, the tiny part.
Well, and you know, I can do this very fast. Long ago now, I saw Pacino doing editors, and needless to say, it was in a part of a workshop, and you've been doing it for 30 years. She was in a loft somewhere, and you couldn't get tickets, you had to call Sam Cohen. But it was as good as I've ever seen it. It was magnificent, and it was the Yeats translation. And weirdly, the thing that got me most about Oedipus in a really good production with him and Diane Wiest was he was finding out all these terrible things the more he found out. And over somebody would come on stage and say, good news! Because it was exactly like life. People always come in and say that, and then they tell you the worst thing that you're talking about. They just don't know that it is. So that even in Oedipus, that kind of observation of what people do in extremis, it was funny. It was horrifying, and it was funny.
Really?
Yeah.
And maybe Ms. Efron, you could lead off, since specifically *Heartburn* has elements of comedy, and it definitely has elements of two people trying to make it work. A colleague here at MoMA told me that she read your book, *Heartburn*, as she was in the hospital giving birth to her daughter, and it gave her such comfort. And I found that such a bizarre thing. And I said, I really am so far away from understanding certain
things about her husband had not left her before she went into labor.
apparently not, but she made it all the way through the book and still found comfort in it. So that bittersweet humor, for lack of a better word, maybe you could talk about Mike's insight into your work and how you found that collaboration.
Oh, well, the first thing we did was Silkwood. And
that was the first?
And I, you know, I just want to say, I met Mike, I interviewed him. I was a journalist, and I interviewed him and did an absolutely wonderful Q&A with him, mostly the A's, not the Q's, and in a very obscure magazine, but it's just a wonderful interview. And I
I'm watching this thing and thinking of everything of Mike that gets into your head, either when you don't know him or when you do. And from things like, I know exactly what you mean, exactly, which is something that, that got into all of our heads from Nichols and May. We all said those things, like that audience who knew all the lines in your movie. And also, Meryl just said that when things go wrong, it's your friend. This is Mike, and these are these parts of vocabulary that become a way that you work on movies. So things, accidents are your friend. One of the things I most regret
it's just like life.
Yes, yeah, and one of the things I regret most when from the movies I did, because they were, that was my first movie, Silkwood, and Heartburn was, I think, my third. But I really didn't understand, as I do now, how much you want to happen in a movie that isn't on the page. And that was a thing that I started to learn, but I did not know it. It was kind of in that Paddy Chayefsky era where you had heard that if anyone changed a word of his movie, they had to pay him his fee all over again, which was a very exciting idea. And, but I just didn't understand that you're always looking for the joke. You're always looking for a way in rehearsal to make something happen off the page, and that is something that I learned watching Mike do two movies. So that is not the answer to your question, but I just had to say that.
Ask a question that merits this answer.
Betrayal, maybe. making deals. Well, I mean, look, part of the reason that we're so thrilled that you're all here is because you have formed some bonds with Mike. And someone, actually a journalist, mentioned to me that the loyalty that's explored in his movies is replicated in his own professional collaborations, and certainly probably in his personal life. But and that is something remarkable, is that here is a man who has worked at every major studio, has made critical and successful hits, but has a very, it seems like, loyal group of collaborators. And that is a question mark for a lot of people these days, is how do you maintain that loyalty? So any insight that any of you have about what Mike brings to the equation in terms of your own contribution that has made you loyal to him?
If I may, before they answer your question, let's address ourselves for a moment to the auteur theory. Because these French guys with cigarette ashes all over them, who years ago decided that Howard Hawks was the greatest director who ever made movies, and who made this pantheon that would not be our pantheon. Jerry Lewis was up there, he's very good, but he wouldn't be high on my list of favorite directors. The point is, they don't understand our movies. Sometimes literally, and always figuratively, just as I don't understand anything in French theater. I don't know what they're doing. They're different conventions, they're different lines. And I think the auteur theory, it's time to get it overhauled. Because Cahiers du Cinéma is no longer published, is it?
Barely.
And because nobody knows, the cigarette ashes are gone, the guys who smoke the cigarettes are gone, the pantheon can't be rethought because nobody cares. Nobody wants to make a pantheon of the directors now dead, because mostly we don't look at those movies. So it's time that we... that there's something about the fact that a movie is made by a group of people. And of course it starts with a writer. It would be ridiculous if it didn't. The movie is its script. It's what the words are. It's the events of the story. It's the script.
But yes, yes. All right. But you do things that other people don't do. And you, in fact, I've quoted you saying this because it's one of my favorite things that Mike said, that he once said that being a director was like making love in that you never see anyone do it but you, and you always want to say to people, is this how other people do it? But, you know, there's a reason why the actors you work with are never better than they are in your movies, and that is just a fact, and it's partly because you know exactly what you're doing as a director, and partly because of the work you do on the script, so that there's a kind of clarity to what the scene's about for the actor. And you do that to those scripts, because I've been in the room with Mike where he's always saying, what is this scene about? What is this section of the movie about? We have to call this disillusion, and if this scene in this section is not about disillusion, it has to go somewhere else. It's always, it's that kind of thing. So yes, we all work with you, and Ann Roth works with you, and Sam Osteen. It was such a joy to watch Carnal Knowledge and watch the work that Sam Osteen does, where you simply do not see a cut in the movie. You don't see it. It's like water or something. It just... but it's, you know, I don't want to get on the side of those Frenchies, but you do something that other people don't do. So,
in all fairness
to you. Wow.
Why are you talking to me?
It's true. You not only do you do that to the script, but you force the writer to do that to the script too, because and the actors, because and the costume people and the people who are putting cushions on the chairs and the people who are writing, they're all telling the same story. They all have the same title. This is or is not disillusion. And I don't know anybody else who does that.
Oh, I do.
Who?
Soderbergh.
I learned it from you then.
I think even one of the glories, the many glories of movies, is that we learn from each other all the time simply by watching movies.
It's true. Did you see Henry Wilson's War?
I saw Charlie.
I'm really, really, really bad at names.
You always want to be Gracie Allen part.
Did there, and I knew nothing about it. Nobody has mentioned it. In all the discussion about what's happening now, and that is what's happening now, nobody mentions that movie. And that movie is a clear and funny and interesting and accurate history of how we got there and maybe what's going to happen to us there and why nobody mentions it. I know that you have been asked about this. And I know I got the name wrong, but this is important. It's so accurate. It's such an important movie to see if you can get hold of it. Because it's, first of all, it's not earnest. It's a very amusing story about a very terrifying topic, which is Mike Strick. And it's very entertaining. But I thought and nothing was happening. And then suddenly, Obama was elected and we were out of Iraq and we were into it. And the movie came true. All of it came true, what I've seen. So I don't know why I bring this up because that subject was done so hilariously. And it doesn't even tell you just about Afghanistan, Pakistan, and my relationships with them. It tells you about Washington. You're horrified. You're more horrified at what's happening in Washington than you are about the war. how business is done, how politics are done, how easy it is to be totally greedy and totally corrupt, and how it's okay, how the standards are different, and by the end of the movie, your standards are different. You know, if a guy just doesn't pick your pocket, you think, pretty good congressman. So it's a, and that's a very good example, I think, of what he does.
And to follow that up, actually, we discovered, and I certainly discovered, that Catch-22 has that relevance today. If we had opened this retrospective a year ago, I would have really lobbied to open this retrospective with Catch-22, because it is such a parable of what we were getting into in Iraq, in terms of the quagmire and the, you know, the kind of, it gets back to betrayal, what I was talking about earlier, the betrayal of a deal that the government is supposed to have with the people. And I do think that that comes through again and again. And maybe we can then circle that back to Silkwood and your portrayal of a woman who thought she maybe, or in my impression of it, thought she had a deal with people and discovers bit by bit that that deal doesn't exist or is not the way that she thought it was.
Yeah, it's. I think that it's a very interesting question how you really reach anybody anymore with any sort of insight, because we're so protected by our self-knowledge and our inability to want to admit anything. Anyway, I mean, earnestness is like is the worst thing you can be, but. I happen to think that everything political is personal. Everything is very, very personal. And the more specific we get about each particular person's problems and played on the grand stage, and that's the lesson of Shakespeare, you know, the more specific the king's neurosis, the more you know events are gonna shake down badly. And that's sort of what Nora was saying about wrestling a difficult script first, before the actors even get there, and is really true. In Angels in America, certainly it was true with Tony, what you did to make filmic something that had worked so beautifully on stage, but obviously you needed to be wrangled in a way. And you couldn't do that with the actors. There, everybody's standing around and going, well, do I have that paragraph? Or do I just have one line? You know, that all that stuff that actors think about. It's great that that work is done invisibly and first, and when we get there, we feel that its tensile strength is just going to hold us no matter what we give it, and that's a very liberating thing for an actor. That's why when you say actors are never better than when you're directing, because you make them feel they're even better than they are, and you give it permission. It's that whole thing.
Thank you.
So just say thank you.
No, that's true.
No, but another thing also about, for example, Angels in America, the scene with Marilyn and Al Pacino as Ethel Rosenberg and Roy Cohn, which I think is maybe the, how many minutes is it, 8 minutes?
Yeah.
The greatest acting I've ever seen in my life. And
I would agree.
And it's one. In a bed and an actor in a chair just talking. There are very few directors who wouldn't say, I can't do this for 8 minutes. I can't. We have to go for a walk. the thing, you know, just looking at that movie and how today, if one were doing that, we'd take a picture of the two of you. We wouldn't be afraid of looking at two people saying those hilarious words. No one would think you had to cut to a pair of sneakers. But that is a thing that happens in Mike Nichols' movies. There are long scenes, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. People just talk and talk, and that is like life. That's like our lives, because we just all live in places where people just talk to each other.
It respects the audience.
So
it has to be said that my experience of this is as follows. The first movie I ever made, which was Virginia Woolf, I didn't get the writer because that wasn't the deal. I got a producer writer who is not part of this conversation. But I was okay because I had to play and I was friends with Albee. And it's not like I called him up and said, could you explain this? I mean, I knew Virginia Woolf and I love Virginia Woolf. And I was sort of on my own, but it was okay because it was already done, it existed. But from that point on, starting with Mr. Henry, the way these movies were made was, what, 6 months, would you say, in the Stone Room? How long were we there?
We just on the one sequence. Well, it was mainly, yeah, two pieces that we worked on. It was a long time.
A long time. We had a long time. And we
remember having a good time. Well, we ate well and listened to a lot of music.
All that's true. And we weren't cast yet. There were no actors yet. There were only the characters. And not only could I not have done it, obviously I couldn't have done it without your script, but I couldn't have done it without that endless conversation in the Stone Room, which is what Buck called. What's his name? Blake Edwards' house, which I rented. When you're in Hollywood, you're always in somebody else's house. And I know it from the first movie when I was at Jennifer Jones's house and then I was at Blake Edwards' house.
You were in Cole Porter's house.
I was in Cole Porter's house. I was in David Geffen's house. But he was alive. He was the first one that was alive.
This is really house shopping.
This is how fine films are made in famous people's houses.
But my point is simple, that conversation that starts long before you're cast, between the writing of the screenplay, which is another conversation with the writer, and the casting at which the writer is also present, it is a conversation that never ends, God knows you know. From the moment that you say, well, let's, you want to maybe do this? What do you think? Would you like to write it? Is there a movie there? What do you think? What would it be? Where would we start? And so forth. And it never ends, even into the cutting room. So I can't think of it as anything but God's collaboration. It's the greatest collaboration I could imagine. Doesn't seem very wet.
In a way, I think, though, it does cycle back to your comments about auteur theory and this idea that one needs to be self-contained and, you know, all-encapsulating genius, writer, director, actor. And that, in a way, has infused independent cinema in America. I think a lot of it is because the people who trained, those people were very much followers of auteur theory. And I think that part of the point of this is to acknowledge that the way maybe movies are made is not that way.
I've always thought it takes two eyes to have three dimensions. And the guy that does it all himself, I mean, you know, we've seen it. It can be great. I mean, they're great geniuses and there are people who can make their whole movie. But I think they're very, very rare. There's one here. There's one here. But you can't. But by and large,
but it's nice of you.
You don't think it's true?
No. But I think everything is situational, as you know.
Different times. Yeah, I think that's true, too. But I think the essence of movies, I'm not being all modest and cute. I think the joy of a movie is that 150 people are making it together. Yes, there's one guy that says, you go, I'll go over there and be quiet. But that doesn't mean that everything comes from the person doing that.
I think the difference is that a lot of directors, I remember Sidney Pollack, I said, oh my gosh, we're almost going to have to, it's almost time to leave Africa. He said, I can't wait to get out of here. Get rid of the actors and just get in the editing room and just make this movie. He always has little tears in his eyes during the day because it's going to be over. And I know you don't like, you love the thing. You love the collegiality and everything.
I do. Yeah. I do. And I love not knowing, nobody knowing what the scene, what's going to happen in the scene so that you say, well, we've got it, let's go on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Nobody
yeah.
knows that until it happens. And that's also not done by one person.
There's no way around this, Mike. You're
very, very good. You'll see.
I wish I could talk into this. Down in office, I scream.
I have actually heard some rumors about this love on the set. And sometimes it going over the top. Mike Haley, a colleague of yours for many years, told me about some. Is Mike here?
Yeah.
There's a character you told me about. What's his name again?
Don Diego Cabrón.
Thank you.
Don Diego makes sacred visits to the set.
Have all of you met Don Diego before?
I have.
What was he wearing?
Very little below the waist.
And yet, the set doesn't collapse. You're prepared for these shenanigans. It's a character.
Mr. Haley has been my first assistant for over half a century. Has a habit of picking the right place and mooning on the set. The first movie we did together, he mooned in more and more elaborate ways. We worked with George Scott, so that in the very crucial scene when Scott opened the locker, there was the I'm proud to say that in the last week of shooting, he was dropped mooning in a parachute from an airplane and landed air ass on our set. It was a beautiful day.
So it's not all script conferences.
If you're open, I'd love to offer a few questions from the audience, perhaps.
Sure.
Sir.
Mr. Nichols, I've read that, contrary to a lot of working directors, you like to rehearse for a couple of weeks before you start shooting.
No, I like to rehearse for 5 weeks, but I'm usually argued down to two, and that really pisses me off.
Well, since that's so contrary to how so many directors work, could you share a little bit about how you approach that and your process and what you're looking to accomplish during that time?
Yes, well, a lot of it is based, first of all, it's based on the fact that, as you know, movies are shot out of order. So if you want to have any kind of architecture to the story and you want the actors to cooperate in that and to understand what you're telling them and why, you have to rehearse because you have to find the shape of the thing. And you also have to begin to find out what the event, the director creates the events of the play or the movie, what's happening. And to wing that, to find it by winging, it can be done. And sometimes the result of winging it leads to things. I was talking to somebody in the lobby and I said, the most famous line reading in the history of movies is Humphrey Bogart saying a line wrong. Here's looking at you, kid. Nobody would say that. Here's looking at you, kid. But did he decide to say it wrong? Did he just get it wrong? Who knows? But it lives. These things happen without rehearsal and without planning. But the story being told,
A good movie is about something, and it's also about something else. And I think of the rehearsals as nurturing the something else. That if you don't know the dark fish that's swimming underneath where you're swimming, and you don't know when it's where, then you're all doing different things. But if you all know, this is where the fish is, only like 3 or 4 feet under us, then everybody is in some way in the same place. I'm not speaking literally, because I didn't make George. You know what I mean?
And do you have any insight, as someone who's gone through the rehearsal process many times with Mike, on how it benefited?
Yeah. I mean, I think that shooting wildly out of order is one thing, but it also, it just sort of creates the world. You get to know everybody. You come in every day, and you get to know everybody. Because a movie is a funny thing. It's not like a play where you're all there every night, and it's sort of feel the gestalt of the whole thing. A movie can be somebody will fly in, do their part, live in their trailer, you never see them, you know, until they come out on the set. It's a different thing if you let it be that.
Not to embarrass you, and don't kill me for this, but the most amazing rehearsal process I ever saw in a movie was Silkwood, which was the first time we worked together.
Yeah.
And we all showed up in Houston.
Yeah, that was a wildly diverse group.
It was a wildly diverse group, and here's what happened. We read the first day, and then we read it the second day, and then we hung out a little bit. And pretty soon, the guy who was Kurt Russell, who was playing her boyfriend, was in love with Miss Street. That took a day and a half. Cher, who was her best friend, was her best friend. Remember that?
I do.
The guys who played the villains were terrified of her, although she hadn't done anything. And this happened day by day, through means we could not perceive. Until finally what happened was I just had to show up on the set. Because you had done the work in some inner way, and they were in the right relationship to you, and all I had to do was say action. That's really happened. You'll bear me out. And a great actor will use the rehearsal process for such spiritual things as well as you stand there, I guess I'll go over here. Yes, we have to do that because the camera doesn't know where to go. But also, we have to have different relationships among the actors. And someone who does it by ways forever mysterious will affect the mysterious parts of the other actors who fit in, and then those relationships are actually their relationships. Mm-hmm. And it's much easier and much more fun to shoot. All you have to do is start. And all the things happen because the people are that with each other. That's what I learned from you.
Gosh.
Another question. All the way in the back.
Will I say a few words about Sam Osteen? Please.
Tell me your relationship to Sam Osteen.
I got his book and I was reading about him all day.
Sam Osteen and I started, it was both our first movie when we did Virginia Woolf. And Billy Wilder, who was very, very helpful to me, had lent me his editing associate, now he had a very fancy title, to help me with how to cut, how to shoot so it would cut. And I hired Sam, what people call to just handle the film, the lowly task of handling the film. Well, Joan Harrison, who was the august editor, left in 3 days, not because he said that I wasn't doing what he said. Well, what he didn't realize is I didn't understand what he said. And that was for a very interesting reason. I realized with horror on the first day when the DP, the director of photography, made a suggestion. And I thought, well, why? And I said, why would you want to do that? And he said, well, it would be interesting. I thought, oh, God, I'm on my own because I'm the only one who knows the story. And because I'm the only one who knows the story, I have to pick the shot. Help me. And Sam became the editor on the third day when Joan Harrison left. And not only did we learn together, but we worked every Saturday and we kept up as we were going. And we were wildly different, but inside in some way. One, we had the same birthday. Two, I don't believe in that stuff, but we did. And we were very different guys, but in this one way we were the same. And we learned from each other, and we had a great time. And he edited my movies endlessly. I don't even know how many movies it was, but it was six or seven. And here's what he did on Virginia Woolf. I'm almost finished, I promise. He had worked for a man, because in those days, the heads of the studios were gods. And the guy he worked for was blackballed by one of the studio heads. And he barely made a living after that, because he couldn't get a job on a movie. And Sam saw that happen. And Mr. Warner, who always dropped the directors after the shooting because it was much faster to have his departments do the sound and so on and so forth. He threw me off the lot, as was his wont. And Sam Osteen, who had seen what happened if you defied this kind of stuff, would call me at night and play me the mix. And I'd say, bring the car down, bring the music up a little bit. And he risked everything. And then I figured out a way to put pressure on Jack Warner, which I'll tell you some other time. And I came back. But Sam was amazing and very important. I think, frankly, in that book, he was already doing what I don't think any of us should do. He was separating out, this was my idea, that was his idea, that was his idea. You don't do that. I don't believe in that. And I don't like it when people start to do it. The DP on Virginia Woolf did it, claimed the little flashing light in the car when the car is gone and dead and the light is flashing. For himself, and of course I knew you can't just make it up. I had to build a car. And it doesn't happen on a real car, is my point. And I was very angry at the DP, but later I realized that's really what you want. You want everybody to say, I thought of that. Because then they come to it in the right way. And I don't think it's a discussion, a disagreement that dignifies anyone. And Sam was pulled a little bit into that by this and that. But for 95% of the time, he was wonderful. And he found things that I couldn't have found, and so forth. Enough?
One or two more. Yes, ma'am.
Your dialogue's always been so rich over the years that you've been making movies. Has the way we talk to each other changed?
People? Has the lady's asking, over all the centuries I've been making movies, has the way people talk to each other changed? I think that there are factions in vocabulary, certainly. You can phrase something like normalcy, a hideous non-word that Herbert Hoover invented in his ignorance, and that my Latin teacher bitched about and said must be expunged from the language. And for some reason, it's come back now. Everybody says normalcy. I don't know why. Normality is a perfectly good word. Stuff like that happens all the time. And different terms and fashions. Fashions change, and they change. And that, by the way, that's the reason that in the end, you're best off making those kinds of movies about your own time. Because it's very hard to understand the fashions, the courting fashions, which change radically. What our teenager thing couldn't possibly happen now. It would be a group, it wouldn't be two people.
I was thinking about that when we looked at the little film, and just the intimacy, just the joy in meeting someone and being intimate with them and speaking in that way. I think, you know, that certainly people, at least my children, would rather text each other than talk on the phone. And, you know what I mean? There's something about that that's changed.
But don't you? I see the movies that I see now, the comedies,
seem to me very, the good ones seem very old-fashioned. Knocked Up, is it very old-fashioned? There's something about Mary, is it totally old? I mean, you do things in it that you wouldn't. You have sex, you prick your nose, you whatever. But the structure of it, the message of it, the responsible father, Iola, they're really like old-time movies, comedies. It's very hard to make a comedy that doesn't have some structure that started in the 80s. I don't find anything funny before then. Somewhere around there, observational comedy, a comedy about behavior and what guys really do when they're in their sweatshirt meeting. That kind of comedy has been going on for a long time, and it's very hard to change it, no matter what language you use. Its plot and its message is somewhat the same.
It's true. On the other hand, the great, great comedies like before us, like all of Preston Sturges' movies, are so much about their specific then, and therefore about us too. But they're not about us literally. There are no more ocean voyages, there are no card sharks anyway, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in every regard. But people laugh their ass off as if it was all familiar, because the inside is familiar.
Well, between the two of us, I do like Preston Sturges, but I personally don't like W.C. Fields. I just don't. I don't like old movies. I don't find them funny. I don't know why they're supposed to be funny. I think Bob Hope himself is funny, but I have never understood what's funny about what he said in it.
Here, here.
So I.
What about to be or not to be?
That was funny. You're right. But that was actually satirical. That was political and satirical, and it was not quite the same as those movies.
There's also a great actor. Carol Lombard saying to the Nazis, I'm very excited.
Yes, to be or not to be.
Well, the same can be said in many ways of your films. I've actually said this, that they're of their time, but they're not forced to remain about their time. That you can look at the films that are set in very distinct periods. I mean, everyone thinks Working Girl is the 80s movie about shoulder pads. But when you look at it, it's not at all about shoulder pads. It just happens to, you know, that's what they happen to be wearing because you make films that are of their time. They end up being very timeless, and you can laugh at them, or with them.
I think that's one of the glories of movies, is that when they connected in their time, when they really worked, when they lived for those people, they will for us. It's not that there aren't people like, for instance, Fields for you, although he makes me laugh like a lot, but everybody has those, because comedy is sort of outside time, without extension, which is, never mind. I think we all think the same thing, that the more that you express what's funny about the time you were in somehow, it will carry into other times.
Yes.
My question is addressed to Mike and Elaine both. Because you have your very special relationship with regarding script doctoring. I've read about her helping on The Birdcage. You mentioned it earlier tonight.
She wrote The Birdcage, first to last. She came and saved my ass on other things. What?
Maybe there's a couple of movies you can refer to that she helped you on that we don't know about.
Right.
And when is the script doctor called in specifically? During the movie? Before the movie? At the end, bunch of a couple of jokes?
Well, it's always the thing of you have to, the executives are always way behind. And sometimes you can get them to grasp that the script isn't ready before. And sometimes it's only when they finally see dailies that they realize that the things that people are saying could be better. And then they finally say, all right, call her up. But you have to understand executives are always, you know, 6 months to a year behind what the people who are actually making the movie are doing. And so the script doctor can then really literally save your life.
But I'm very, with Mike, if you say to Mike, gee, the credits could be shorter, he says, you've done it. You say, it's you.
Destin movie with the woman?
Tootsie.
Tootsie came and Elaine came to Tootsie and did four or five scenes and completely transformed it and humanized it and made everything that already existed live and made it a great movie. You know you did.
Well, actually, I did more than four or five scenes. Well, there was, it's a tilt. The movie, when it started, the hero didn't like being a woman, and he couldn't stand his clothes, and he just wanted to be, you know, see women naked. But Dustin himself just loved his part. He would come in during a script conference and say, I hate my dress. This is a horrible wig, and my makeup is, and I thought, he loves this part. Method actor, and that's actually what was it.
That was the thing you put in the movie.
Yeah, right? And Sydney as an agent. But that tilt, and it's really like a head tilt. Do you? Is it like Dustin, or is it?
May
like
I tell the story about the wallpaper? This is a story about movies. This is a story about script doctors and what they do for a movie. They needed a star, they needed an interesting woman, but when they were turned down and turned down and turned down, and Elaine said, well, I'm going to write a scene for the woman that so that we can get somebody good interested. And she wrote the scene where Dustin is apparently a woman and lying in bed with the real woman in her room that she grew up in. And Elaine gave her a speech about the wallpaper in the room and what it had meant to her when she was growing up. And they got a great actress. What's her name?
Her name is Henry Wilson.
It was Jessica Lange. And they got her on the strength of that scene. What more can we say? That's what a script doctor does, and then you proceed from there. And it was a terrific movie, which it hadn't been before. So the doctor saved the life of the patient.
Well.
Well, you don't know about MoMA.
No.
This happens during screenings, too. It's in Subway.
I thought it was a giant stomach mumbling.
Putting in a subway going by. Subway going by.
Like you said, but that's fascinating. Does the audience not realize that it's not part of the movie?
I think eventually they realize because there's train after train.
Sometimes it has to time perfectly, you know, to the chase scene or the orgasm or whatever it is. Sometimes. We show French movies.
Said when I was doing Barefoot in the Park, I'll do it if I can get that blonde guy I saw in Playhouse 90. So I had no problem wanting a Robert Redford type, and we were good friends and so on. But I tested him and Candace Bergen. I tested a lot of people. And Redford, and what I said to Candace, here's a good Redford story. We were playing pool at Blake Edwards. And he was talking about the test, and I said, it was no good, you were wonderful, but you can't play this. You could never play a loser in a million years. He said, of course I could. I said, no, you can't. I'm looking at you. You could not possibly play a loser. He said, that's not true, honestly. And I said, all right, have you ever struck out with a woman? And he said, what do you mean? Story short, there was a copy of Mad magazine after The Graduate was a hit, and it was a scene between Dustin and Benjamin and his parents, and he came and he said, Mom, how come I'm Jewish and you and Dad aren't? And I never said to myself, I need a Jew here. But I did say, when we had seen like 400 guys, I did say, let's bring, there's a guy that I saw in the play, The Fifth Horseman or whatever it was, that played a transvestite Russian fishwife. There was, did you see it?
No.
The scene where he was actually cutting fish. And
Woody Allen was a transvestite German cripple.
No,
you are crazy. That's crazy. And
in Journey of the Fifth Horse?
That's not the title.
Maybe I've
but it was something like that. Ronald Ridman played. And he was totally convincing on all three things.
Yeah. He was great. Remarkable. So then he came out and he tested, and he was one of those people that are very rare. Streak is one, and it's that they have a deal with Technicolor that when you see the film, they're like 20% better than when they did it the day before on the floor. And Dustin was such an actor, and then we had him and we were happy. But it's all these stories about Redford and Doris Day, nobody ever offered it to Doris Day. This stuff rose up around it. But I think the point is that I've made a great point now, is that he needed to be an outsider for this story to happen. And we didn't even know that until we'd seen all these other actors not make it.
Do one last. Yes, Matt, right there.
It sounds like you watched all the films to decide which ones would screen for the retrospective. And I wonder if you could talk about what these movies that you've fallen in love with as you paid them have done for you.
The repertoire was chosen by Raj.
Oh, okay.
And it was his idea to start with chronology and everything. Although I must say, and I agree, I mean, I think he's running the right movie, with one exception.
Just that sense of Meryl described that you love these films, that you have tears in your eyes the last few days, when you think of these films, have they given you specific gifts? What do you get out of them yourself?
That's an interesting and terrifying question.
Great question.
The answer is I really don't know. Watching your own movie, as everybody on the stage will tell you, is a very different and odd experience. Because, of course, it brings back, first of all, hundreds of people, literally, that were part of this and they were part of that and poor so-and-so and all that stuff. It brings back who you were at the time and what your life was. And sometimes things look no longer as good as they did. And sometimes they look better and sometimes they look the same. So, and it all changes all the time. We ran Catch 22 just to check the print. And this movie, which was so serial, I mean, it just seemed like a documentary. Everything had caught up with it. And it's pretty much the way the country is run, and certainly the armed forces. And the whole idea of becoming pure market forces, which we now have, and we're still on the way to when we made Catch 22, is very startling. But that's life. That's not the movie. The movie and Joe Heller, who dreamed this dream, was really
it's like if de Tocqueville could see it in 1840, then Joe Heller didn't have that much trouble writing Milo Mindabunder and the shares and the whole business aspect of Catch 22. So that, listen to me, this is the answer to your question. It's very rarely an emotion. It's about what has happened in the world and where the movie takes you now. And with your own as well as with the people that you admire, it's very interesting to see. And I have to admit, there's a sort of thing where you think, well, I wasn't a total schmuck.